You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today's show, we're going to go back to 1960 in the pivotal presidential election that year between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. We all know how it turned out, and many of us have heard various theories that explain the outcome. My guest today co-authored a new book that offers a different take based on some new information that comes to light, as well as some old-fashioned research and investigative reporting that they did. I think you'll find this as fascinating as I did. The author is Paul Kendrick, and the book is titled 9 Days, The Race to Save Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life and Win the 1960 Election. Paul, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin. Really excited to talk about it.
Well, you co-authored this book with your dad, Stephen Kendrick, which I think is really cool. It's not the first one you did together. But tell me, or share with our listeners here, what kind of led you to this? I mean, this, again, the outcome's planted in our mind, and there's all these theories about it, but you kind of found a different angle here that I think has some, definitely have some foundation to it.
Thank you. Yeah, it is uncommon writing books with your parents. Some of my friends say they didn't even enjoy, you know, having a parent edit their paper in high school, much less embarking on long research and books. But my dad and I share a passion for history, and this is our third book, and really have a nice working relationship and no ego and an enthusiasm for collaboration and for how you bring a story out and to a reader and make it memorable and with a narrative that draws them in, but with a lot of fresh research that helps our understanding. And how this came about was a neighbor of ours said, well, you know, Paul, you're really passionate about civil rights. You should talk to my mentor, a man named Harris Wofford. And when I first met Harris, he is so kind and so interested in you, so lovely to be around, so funny, that you could forget he became a senator from Pennsylvania. And he was in his 80s when I met him, but he had been the link between Martin Luther King Jr. and JFK. He had been an advisor to King because of his passion for nonviolence, and then had worked on the Kennedy campaign and had been instrumental in the story that became our book about King's, the crisis of King's imprisonment before Election Day, and how this civil rights team kind of went rogue to help get King out and shift black voters decisively in a narrow election to the Democratic Party. And so we came to feel, we thought, well, we want to really record Harris's memories, but we also, as we did more research on it, realized there were so many characters that are often overlooked, and we'll talk about them all more. But whereas it's very interesting to come into the book through our interests in Kennedy and King and Nixon and getting to see them as young men making quick decisions that would define history, really consequential decisions, but then to learn about other figures that were a little more behind the scenes, like the trio that Harris was, this interracial trio on the Kennedy campaign working on civil rights and the Atlanta student movement and King's lawyers. So it's a really rich, dramatic story because a lot happened in these 9 days.
All the major figures of the 1960s are included here. And again, as you say, some behind the scenes folks, which is really interesting. You know, my recollection of the campaign, I was of course, I was very young at the time, but as I read about it, the prevailing narrative seemed to be, well, those TV debates, that's when the advent of TV and Kennedy won because of that. Well, those debates were pretty much over by the time a lot of the events in your book took place. And then that the Kennedy's Catholicism wound up being a key factor. You know, so those were some of the theories. But I'll confess, I really wasn't aware of what this was going on. So start us off at the beginning, Paul, if you would, set the stage for what happened here that led to these critical events.
Yeah. One thing that is fascinating about this election is it was so close in so many states. And so that's what's different between that and we just had a narrow election in a few of the states in this most recent one. But in the 1960 election, you had so many states that were decided by a few thousand votes. So a lot of things, everything, especially something, an event like this, and we'll talk about it, mattered and made a difference. And black voters in their shift made a difference. So in setting the scene, we have to get the reader to an unfamiliar place. And that place is, as we begin the 1960 campaign, understanding that Richard Nixon was seen as more sympathetic to civil rights than John Kennedy. He had befriended Martin Luther King. King's father had endorsed him. And it looked like the black vote might split about 50-50. You had, in Atlanta, where King is from, black voters are totally Republican. They are persecuted by Georgia Democrats, the Dixiecrats across the South. And so that's different because the Nixon of the late 60s and 70s is what exists in our historical memory. But there was this other path that was there for him that he had built up. And you kind of find out what happens there. But then also understanding that King was an emerging leader. He had had the Montgomery bus boycott, and then 4 years had passed, and I was really interested to learn about the extent to which he was struggling. There was a lot of self-doubt for a 31-year-old Martin Luther King about, you know, was he a one-hit wonder? How was he going to make national change? People wanted him to achieve civil rights legislation in America. How was he going to change a nation's hearts and minds? And so the sit-in movement explodes in 1960. And he's moved home to Atlanta from Alabama, and students who he knew, who he'd grown up with, these are black Atlanta college students at Morehouse, Spelman, Clark, they tell him, we want you to go to jail with us. And for King, that was an agonizing decision, but one he ultimately decides that he must do. He must do this thing that makes him so uncomfortable, that is so dangerous in the 1960 South, to put his body on the line to force his city of Atlanta to desegregate. But the students wanted to force the politicians to talk about civil rights. So Kennedy and Nixon were pretty happy to avoid the issue of civil rights. But that's where this trio that was working on the campaign. So you had Harris Wofford, my friend, and then Sergeant Shriver, and they had recruited a Chicago defender, a black newspaper editor named Louis Martin, who's kind of a hero of the book, to come help them because they realized they were in trouble. They were not reaching black voters. Kennedy was viewed as a privileged, kind of aloof, accommodating to Dixiecrat candidate. And Louis, along with these two white teammates who really empowered him, who really had his back and listened to him, had a vision for how Democrats could win over black voters. And so that's the stage that is really set for King going to prison, which is an October surprise, and how these two candidates, these two campaigns are going to respond to that.
And King, really, what's interesting to me, you do a great job in the book of pointing it out. Again, we've all got our mental images of this, but King actually followed the students. They were, I mean, yeah, he respected what they were doing. They were out front, and he felt it vital that he go to show support, not the other way around.
Yeah, that was really, and so we kind of got into the book through Harris, and then it was such a joy to get to know surviving Atlanta student movement veterans and spending time with them in Atlanta. And the leader of the Atlanta student movement was named Lonnie King. Unfortunately, he and Harris both passed away in 2019. But one thing that Lonnie really made clear to us, and as well as the other student leaders, is King really supported them. He would show up to meetings that they were doing to their skeptical college administrations. But he didn't try to take over their movement. He listened to young people. He was pretty young. He was 31. They were in their, you know, early 20s, late teens. And I think there is a lesson in there for all of us about listening to young people who often energize social movements, who bring their, to bring a healthy impatience with inequalities, to say we have to do this bold thing to make people talk about it, make them not turn away, make them confront change that is needed. And so for King, for a few reasons, he didn't want to go to jail. His father really didn't want him to. And so there's some really dramatic scenes where the students are putting a lot of pressure on him to live, to practice what he preached, because they had been inspired by what he did in Montgomery with the civil disobedience of the Montgomery bus boycott. But now they had a new approach in the sit-ins, and they were saying, it's time for you. We've been laying our body on the line. You know, people like John Lewis from the Nashville side of things was saying that now it's time for you to do that. And so that's a different King, because so often I think we understand the civil rights movement as just kind of about him, but there's a lot more complexity to it. And there were brave women and men, and in this case, young people, who really helped King, take this step and have this experience. And as you see in the book, what he faces down allows him to go on to become the national leader and face down what he had to do in Birmingham to make national change. But the students really brought that out of him, and they loved him and he loved them. And so it's a very poignant relationship to be able to tell with some nuance, with the help of those that were part of it.
So the narrative could have just gone where they are thrown in jail, which was part of a conscious strategy. But there was a complication from King's life that threw a wrench into this and really gets into some very harrowing narrative that you and your dad outline. That's you've just got to read it to really grasp the seriousness of what happened.
Thank you. That's exactly right. That King had been racially profiled when he was driving a movement supporter to a cancer treatment appointment, and he had gotten a ticket for still having an Alabama license. He hadn't gotten a Georgia one yet, and he didn't really understand that the judge gave him a suspended sentence, and because of this, what ends up happening is he goes from the relative safety of the Atlanta jail, this neighboring county, DeKalb, which in the most recent election in the Senate runoff, you know, is a diverse, emerging like liberal place, but then it was thought of as Klan country.
Yeah.
And this judge gets a hold of King and sentences him to 4 months in the very dangerous rural Reidsville state prison. And so suddenly the King family, this was the moment that Coretta writes that they were most scared for King's life, and he risked his life every single day of his career, but this was, Daddy King was convinced he was going to, this was a way that he could be quietly killed, and he would be kind of a historic footnote had that happened at this moment. And so he is woken up in the middle of the night from the where he was being held in Decatur, put in the back of a police car. And he's not told where he's going. He thought he was going to be lynched. He thought he was never going to see his family again. And he's driven across the state to the state prison. And so what King went through that night, King's associates like Andrew Young told me, after that, King could really face down anything, because he'd kind of been to the door of death. He had really faced what his mission entailed. But it was, every minute counted. They had to get him out of Reidsville, but he was facing 4 months on a chain gang, so it was going to be a really perilous thing. And that's, and so that's where Harris Wofford, having his relationship with King, being a friend to him, he suddenly gets the Kennedy campaign intervening in this situation, and that would ultimately change this election.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Paul Kendrick, who with his dad, Stephen, co-authored a new book called 9 Days, The Race to Save Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life and Win the 1960 Election. I'm getting fired up here just talking about it again, because I was during the book, but it's a thriller. It's hard to put down, and we just had a key moment. Paul just described it. My God, this drive in the middle of the night, 3:30, Dr. King's awakened, and he's driving, and he thinks that's it. And the words you use, where he describes being in jail and the mental anguish, it was worse than dying, just very powerful. But he is taken to this jail after all. And then comes, as you describe, the back channels that really put pressure on Jack Kennedy to make a call, which really was one of the most important calls in the history of this country.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right that I just think we sometimes take for granted the courage that King had, and I think when you read the story, you understand what he was willing to do, and that is something that I hope inspires all of us for whatever ways we can be bold in our lives for what is right. But you're right. So King has been sentenced to 4 months in a perilous state prison. And so both campaigns have this question of what they're going to do about it. And we kind of trace what's happening in both campaigns, where so Nixon had two fantastic black advisors, Jackie Robinson, the baseball legend, and an Eisenhower White House, first ever White House staffer, E. Frederick Morrow. So they're pushing Nixon to speak up for his friend. King's the Atlanta student movement members, they think Nixon's going to speak up for him because, Robinson, Morrow, they wanted the Republican Party to be the party of civil rights, the party that leads on it. But then, meanwhile, on the Kennedy side, because Nixon is not listening to these black advisors, he's being very tempted by trying to flip the white South and thinks this is probably too explosive of a situation to touch with this controversial activist minister. Meanwhile, on the Kennedy campaign, Coretta calls Harris Wofford because, again, Harris was a white guy who went to Howard Law School because he wanted to ground himself in black life to be able to work on civil rights change, and he had been inspired by Gandhi, and he'd heard this minister Montgomery was doing Gandhism in America, and so had befriended King. And so now Coretta calls their friend Harris, who's on the Kennedy campaign, saying that they're going to kill Martin. And what happens from there is Louis Martin, the black Chicago staffer, and Harris have this idea. Kennedy ought to just call Coretta, do something human, not just a stilted press release, like a gesture. And so they get this idea to Sergeant Shriver, who was back home for him at the time in Chicago. And there was going to be an event at O'Hare Airport that morning. And Shriver drives out to the O'Hare Inn, which is no longer there, but was near the O'Hare Airport, and waits till Kennedy's advisors are gone and gives the idea to Kennedy. Hey, would you call this pregnant wife of King? She's scared. And King, and Kennedy, to his credit, thinks that, well, that's a decent thing to do. They don't understand this is going to be part of shifting American politics. He just does it. But Kennedy, as you'll learn in the book, was also working some back channels because Harris had gotten the Kennedy campaign involved in this thing a couple days before, and it had become a bit of a public brouhaha unintentionally. And so the Kennedy brothers, they were pretty furious with these three civil rights advisors for getting them involved in this explosive situation, but their instincts were to solve it. And so there's where there's some fascinating Georgia characters and kind of the elements of this thriller that just are naturally what the story was, for how they're working with the most unlikely of people to try to get this problem solved for their party and get King out, which eventually culminates in Bobby calling the judge. But it wouldn't have happened had this interracial trio of civil rights advisors not really forced the issue. And eventually Kennedy, to his credit, listens and takes that action of calling Coretta.
And these calls behind the scenes are ultimately fruitful with the judge who you know, allows King out of jail. The case isn't settled, but he is out, which is a major breakthrough. And I've got to shift and have you talk about the Blue Bomb. That's probably something that very, very few people were aware of. And I think, again, you and your dad, the investigation on it is really fascinating. Share with our listeners what that was, and as far as how quickly that came about and how kind of quietly and a little deceptively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this was really Louis Martin's moment to shine, that he felt, well, you know, my candidate did this really decent thing, but I don't know if Black voters have really focused in on it and given him the credit for it. And he and Harris have this idea of a pamphlet about what Kennedy, quote, the candidate with the heart, as they put on the cover, did versus what Nixon did, which was stay silent. And their boss, Sergeant Shriver, despite being the Kennedy's brother-in-law, but the Kennedys viewed Shriver very skeptically. They called him the too liberal-in-law. They were worried he was too idealistic and passionate. Shriver says, "Let's do it, and I'll get you the money, and we're just not going to tell my brother-in-laws about it. We're just going to make it happen." And so, you know, Shriver, again, really empowering and listening to Louis Martin. In Louis saying, this is what I think will can win us the election. And so because Louis had worked for the Chicago Defender, he knew people who mattered in Black communities all over America. And that allowed them to do this distribution through churches and barber shops and just institutions of Black life, where they estimate that 2 million pamphlets went out as they got reprinted in different places, and that people at the time said it was spreading like wildfire. Mm-hmm. But here was the key. White voters never focused in on it. So Louis Martin was telling the story to Black voters of what Kennedy did without the risk and the drawback of white voters penalizing him for it if they, you know, disagreed with what he had done. And so it was like kind of the beginning of micro-targeting in a way, but an incredible piece of electoral machination. But building off what Louis thought was, you know, just the morally right thing that Kennedy had done. And so when at the end of all this and the culmination of all their efforts, that because they treated outreach as Black outreach for the first time as a substantive civil rights-based outreach, and not just, you know, walking around money paying some celebrities. They had talked about issues throughout the final months of the campaign, and the Blue Bomb was like the icing on the cake, and ultimately 7 percentage points of the Black vote shipped to the Democrats from 1956, and never again is the Black vote nearly that close. It was a kind of a turning point where, you know, we have today roughly 90% of African Americans voting Democrat, but Nixon's Southern strategy eventually happens. He does eventually win the White South, but that won't come till 1968 and 72. So we have this transformation in the parties as the Civil Rights Act further then accelerates it. But this was a key moment where Nixon, you know, could have claimed that mantle. Kennedy did, and Louis Martin, with his teammates Wofford and Shriver, decided they were going to have a really clever way of telling that powerful story, and really bringing home that linkage between Kennedy and King, and Black voters choosing the Democrats as the party that would address civil rights.
Did you get a copy of that? Is there still some circulating?
Yeah, Kennedy Library in Boston, it was cool to hold one in my hand, and we, you know, we quote it in the book. What was amazing is we were doing an event for the Atlanta History Center with some of the Atlanta Student Movement veterans that were a part of these days, and Charles Black, who was one of them, held up that he had one, and that was really cool. But the book, you know, describes the scenes of like churches on the south side of Chicago where Shriver actually went to watch the distribution happening. He brought his little daughter, Maria Shriver, with him that day and just saw people just filing out, reading these things, and realized there was a power to it and understood Louis's insight that we don't need the newspapers. You know, we're not going for, the New York Times. What we're going to do is reach the Black community. And as Louis said, to white journalists, it might as well have been written in Chinese. Like they're just reaching the audience they wanted, and creating the shift, that Louis from the outset of the campaign believed was possible. However Black people voted in the past, he believed they could be Democrats. And so, you know, Louis Martin really, shifted American politics. But the Kennedy brothers, to their credit, listened in a way that Nixon did not, even though they at the outset probably would have rather avoided the whole issue. But they ultimately got it solved to get King home to his family in Atlanta.
We got about 1 minute left, Paul. What kind of summed this up, I guess, the legacy here of this? You've touched on it throughout, but to kind of summarize in just a minute here, what the legacy of these historic events that you and your dad have now shown a brighter light on and their significance in our history?
Thank you. Well, I hope the story inspires people to take action in our time. You know, the characters did the things that they made them uncomfortable. They got out of their comfort zones, that they took risks for equality, for civil rights. And then ultimately there was a new presidential administration, and then it was a long journey of pushing that administration to act for civil rights, and we're at the start of one right now. And so that calls to us through the years. But I think in our time, listening to those with perspectives that aren't our own and different lived experiences, as Shriver and Wofford did with their teammate Louis Martin, remains so important. And then ultimately, you know, we have to do things that are courageous, morally, politically, just in our own lives, because Nixon did not do this, but these characters spoke up when there was an injustice happening, when there was an inequality, and we have to do the same today.
Well, for me anyway, one of the qualities of great writing is when you know the outcome. I mean, I knew what was going to happen. Kennedy was going to win, obviously, but keeps the pages turning. And so it's a great, again, it reads like a thriller packed with new information. And I recommend this to our listeners out there. If you've got some interest, some time, it's a great book on many levels. It's called 9 Days, The Race to Save Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life and Win the 1960 Election. Authors are the father-son combo of Stephen Kendrick and Paul Kendrick. And Paul, thank you very much again for being our guest today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.